Our next case for argument is 22-2202, Caring Hands Health Equipment and Supplies versus the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Tolchin, am I saying it right?
You said it right.
Mr. Tolchin, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. We're here on an appeal from the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals that granted summary judgment. The order granted summary judgment to the government and denied, our cross motion. It was a partial cross motion. With respect to a contract dispute involving effectively two sets of contracts. So there really are four issues that are before the court. And first one is, are these requirements contracts? Second one is, are these illusory non-contracts, no contracts? Third is, are they indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity IDIQ contracts? And I guess the fourth issue is, are the facts undisputed in this amount because in these regards, because this matter was decided on summary judgment. So if there are any factual disputes, then the court should reverse the CBCA.
Let's start on the 2015 contracts. You say on page one of your gray brief, the 2015 contracts state explicitly that they are requirements contracts.
Yes.
Can you show me where that is?
Paragraph C1. It appears several times because there are several contracts, but you can find it. I have one marked here on page 1040 of the appendix. And what C1 says is, and I'll read the entire paragraph, the volume or amounts shown in the contract line item numbers cleanse are estimates only and impose no obligation on the VA. And this is the key, because this now is the key sentence. The contract shall be for the actual requirements of the VA as ordered by the VA during the life of the contract. Now, I can't come up with any more clear language as to...
Well, how about all requirements? Wouldn't that be clearer?
It says shall be for all the actual requirements. I don't think there's any difference in the English language. If I say I'm ordering your requirements or I'm ordering all your requirements, it means the same thing, your requirements. The actual requirements. That's what it says. So if you ask me, is there a statement here? It's absolutely clear. And I know that we tend to be loose in our language and try to say using the word all adds something to a sentence, but it doesn't.
How about the FAR provision for requirements contracts? Wouldn't that be a clearer way of stating this is a requirement?
It should have been in here. My client didn't draft the contract. The government drafted the contract. But it's not in here. And the case law is absolutely clear that it doesn't have to be in here for this to be a requirements contract. The cases say, and in fact, the Board of Contract Appeals used the Christian doctrine to say that it has to be interpreted to be in part of, in the contract. The requirements clause has to be in the contract by law, and it is inherently there under the Christian doctrine. I don't think the Court of Federal Claims has said that, but the Court of Federal Claims says we don't need the clause in here for it to be a requirements contract, and the Federal Circuit hasn't spoken to that particular issue. But it, logic tells you, it doesn't have to be there. I look at contracts all the time, and I see the way contracting officers draft contracts, and there are always problems in the way they draft the contracts. There just are. And it's up to the contracting officer to do it correctly. And if they don't do it correctly, they can't then sit back and say, I'm sorry, we're not allowing this contract to be enforced because I didn't put a clause in there that the law says should be in there, but the case law says doesn't have to be in there for it to be a requirements contract. But when this clause says you're going to order the requirements, that's it. And, the Board of Contract Appeals said, well, you've got to read this in the context of the first sentence, which says the volumes or amounts shown are estimates only. But that is a clause that is mandated in a requirements contract, but for some reason, the judge in the Board of Contract Appeals read that as being something that made this not a requirements contract when FAR says, 16.503, that it must be in a requirements contract. But again, the Board of Contract.
That same estimates language has to be in an indefinite quantity contract. That's not a requirements contract, isn't that correct?
It has to be in both.
Right.
It has to be in both.
Are we talking about right now, I'm sorry, just to keep track, the 2014 contracts or the 2015? What are you focusing on?
2015. Okay, 2015. Right. The court asked me to focus first on that.
That the magic words of exclusivity are when you say this contract is for the actual requirements as ordered.
Right. And again, 16.503.
As opposed to it meaning, well, in each order, these are actual requirements needed at a particular time as reflected by the specific order.
But that's not what it says. It says as ordered during the life of the contract. It doesn't say at a specific, it says during the life of the contract, as ordered during the life of the contract. Okay, but during the entire...
Each individual order is for the actual requirements at that time that they needed. So somebody needed this many Band-Aids or this much somewhere. Those were the actual requirements in that area done during the, and sequentially during the course of the contract. That's what I understood the government to want, the magic language to mean. Whereas if it had read all the requirements, that would have then been much more words of exclusivity.
Okay, and I can answer that in two ways. One, 16.503 of FAR says there has to be a clause in there that says, as ordered. That's a requirement of a requirements contract. So that's all that says. This is a mandated, this concept of as ordered is mandated by FAR in a requirements contract.
It has meaning.
It has meaning. It means as ordered, which means...
And I appreciate, I think your case from 2015 hangs on that one, those words. That's it.
Well,
if those words didn't exist in the contract, i.e. contract is for the actual requirements as ordered, you wouldn't have a case.
Well, it's these words combined with the fact that there's nothing that contradicts these words. Okay, so if there were other clauses in there, like an IDIQ clause,
if those words didn't exist in the contract, you'd have a hard case.
Right, but in this case, you only have these words. You don't have IDIQ words or any other words, and... There's nothing anywhere, whether it's an IDIQ or anything, there's nothing that contradicts these words. And that's the key. If you have a word, if you have a clause, and it says clearly what it says, you're going to order requirements of the government, and there's nothing that contradicts this, then this court should be finding that these are requirements contracts. Now, remember what the Board of Contract Appeals did is that they said it's an illusory contract. It's meaningless. It doesn't mean anything. The government doesn't have to do anything. Now, think about that. What the Board of Contract Appeals says is that even though it says the contract shall be for the actual requirements of the VA, that doesn't mean anything because this contract doesn't mean for the actual requirements of the VA. It means the VA can ignore it. Now, that makes very little sense. That makes no sense whatsoever.
You're saying that the sentence, basically, if we read it the way the government would have us read it, the words for the actual requirements of the VA are entirely superfluous because that sentence could be modified to say the contract shall be for whatever ordered by the VA during the life of the contract.
That's the problem. That's the problem with the Board of Contract.
So your interpretation renders that language entirely superfluous.
The Board of Contract goes and the government's interpretation renders it.
And they drafted it?
The government drafted it.
And
this is all
from... Can you construe language as a general canon of construction against the drafter?
Absolutely.
Okay. These are friendly questions.
Yeah, I understand. These are drafted by the government, should be interpreted against the government.
But is it ambiguous? Is it patent?
Yeah, okay. So that's what the Board of Contract Appeals fell back on. It's a patent. First of all, the case law says that the characterization of a contract doesn't fall under the rubric of patent versus latent versus ambiguous. The issue of patent versus latent is a factual issue. You know, does it say 2 or does it say 20? Okay, those are patent versus latent ambiguities, factual. It says when it comes to the characterization of the contract, there's no such thing. You don't even apply the rubric of patent versus latent. Okay, that's one. And two is...
Okay, but if it's ambiguous, what happens here?
If it's ambiguous, you interpret it against the government. But the ambiguity here would clearly not be patent because there's nothing in it that contradicts it. So a patent ambiguity means
why isn't the absence of the FAR requirements provision and the absence of the word all actual requirements, why aren't those patent ambiguities that you had an obligation to bring up?
So does the absence of a clause create a patent ambiguity? I'm not sure if the word is patent versus patent. I'm not sure. But... Does it create? I've never seen a case, and it doesn't make sense to me that the absence of something creates a patent ambiguity, especially when the case law says that that clause doesn't have to be here for this to be a requirements contract. So it makes no sense logically, and there's no case that says that that's what a patent ambiguity is. So there's no patent ambiguity, and perhaps you can argue that there's a latent ambiguity. And so if so, then it's interpreted against the government. But more importantly, you don't even get to this issue versus patent versus latent.
Have you waived out or forfeited any latent ambiguity argument? I thought your brief said there's no ambiguity.
We said there's no patent ambiguity. I honestly do not think that there is an ambiguity here. When the contract says you're going to order actual requirements, it says you're going to order actual requirements. Our argument below was that we should get summary judgment because it is so
Look, I get it. You're going to argue it's not ambiguous, and guess what? They're going to argue it's not ambiguous. That doesn't mean it isn't ambiguous. Did you argue in the alternative, if the court concedes it, construes it as ambiguous, here's what should happen? Did you make that argument in the alternative? People do that a lot. People say, I don't think it's ambiguous,
yes.
But if you think it's ambiguous, here's what should happen.
Yes, we argued that contra preferentum, that if it is ambiguous, it's interpreted against them, and it's not a patent versus latent issue.
You did that on pages 13 to 16 of your brief, right?
What's that?
You did it on pages 13 to 16 of your brief.
Correct. Correct. And we argued the same thing below. I'll turn very, very briefly now. I know I'm into my 5-minute rebuttal. Do you want to
touch on 2014?
Yeah, very briefly. 2014 is a harder case for us.
Don't
think that I don't recognize that.
Yeah.
The issue in 2014.
I might suggest nearly an impossible case for you, but continue, please.
The issue with the 2014 is there a question of fact? I don't think we have the argument there that it's absolutely clear. But in 2014, are there questions of fact that would mandate the summary judgment not be granted? And we think that there are questions of fact, and we raise those questions. Biggest question is, 2014 contracts all supposedly contained a PWS performance work statement. It's incorporated by reference on page 1 of each one of those 2014 contracts. But the government never produced it. It's not part of this file. And we couldn't get it from the government. The government can't find it. We did have one government witness who said he's pretty sure that it would have been the same PWS as was in the 2015 contracts because it's the same basic thing. And the PWS in the 2015 contracts contained a clause that's what we've been looking at, the actual requirements clause. So were there questions of fact? We think that there are questions of fact that precluded summary judgment with respect to 2014 contracts.
Where would that fact take you if you went back?
Because then we'd have the same actual requirements language in 2000.
Well, no, you really wouldn't. How do you know whether it was in the contract or not?
Because we know that there was a PWS that was attached to that contract. We don't have a copy of it. We think the government has a copy.
How do you know there was one attached?
Because it says on page 1 of each of the 2014 contract that the PWS SOW is attached as exhibit blank. And they're not. And the government witness said, pretty sure it's 2015, the same as the 2015. We don't have it. That in and of itself is a question of fact, and that should have included summary judgment.
Okay,
and I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Yep, let's save the rest for rebuttal. Mr. Long, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. With respect to the 2015 contracts, the absence of the requirements clause creates strong questions, at the very least, about the nature of this contract. The requirements clause that's mandated by the FAR is quite clear. It says that the government shall order everything described in the schedule from this contractor. There's nothing that meets that level of definiteness in this contract.
Well, it doesn't have to meet that exact level of definition.
No.
It doesn't have to. I mean, it says for the actual requirements of the VA. And the one issue you have to convince me of is what meaning would that have other than seeking to be a requirements contract? Because I can literally extract those words and read the sentence without them. And it's exactly what you think, if I extract them, the whole thing should mean. Which means that your reading renders those words completely superfluous. Your Honor, that bothers me, and you drafted the contract. So go ahead and tell me what that's your hard hurdle with me, at least in this case.
Understood, Your Honor. The board focuses, and we focus in our briefs, on that prior sentence as well, the estimates only language.
The prior sentence, he's exactly right. The FAR requirements contract has that prior sentence in it. So how could that prior sentence be indicative of not being a requirements contract when the FAR requirements provision has the sentence in it?
That's not exactly my point, Your Honor. My point is that when you read this language, which is obviously not the requirements clause, together, when you read this language together, as it appears in paragraph C.
It's obviously not the requirements clause. You mean
so,
it's
I'm
not
sorry.
FAR?
Yes, I apologize.
Okay, because I kind of think it is a requirements clause. That's where I'm going. That's the
understood.
Problem.
I apologize. I meant that it is not the FAR mandated version of a requirements clause. When you read the language together, the prior sentences sentence states that these are estimates only in the schedule, and the subsequent sentence clarifies that statement by saying that the contract is for the actual requirements of VA as ordered by the VA. And so that first phrase that you're concerned about rendering superfluous is a clarification of what precedes. And so it's not superfluous for that reason.
No, that's not right. The second sentence could say, the contract shall be for the amounts ordered by the VA during the life of the contract. And that would equally take care of exactly the concern you said for the actual requirements language takes care of. The first sentence could say, these are estimates, and the second sentence could say, the contract shall be for the amounts ordered during the life of the contract. You gave no meaning to those words whatsoever. So try again.
The meaning that we would offer, Your Honor, is what I've just stated. I understand Your Honor's view of it, but that's the interpretation that we believe.
You can't just say it's my view of it. You have to actually say why it's wrong. Why am I wrong that you haven't actually imbued any meaning to those words, that the rest of the sentence continues to do exactly what you just said in the absence of those words?
Yeah, Your Honor, I don't have an alternative interpretation that would address the concern that you've raised.
Okay, fair enough. I really appreciate the genuineness of your response and that you didn't try to BS me. Thank you for that.
Does that mean that at minimum the language that you've now discussed is at least susceptible to the meaning that the plaintiffs here want it to have?
Well, Your Honor, it's a rule of contractual interpretation that the contract to be interpreted in a manner, and this is what Chief Judge Moore is referring to, in a way that doesn't render any phrases superfluous. And so I think that then if the court is going in the direction that I'm understanding, then yes, I think at that point we have to ask ourselves what then this phrase is intended to mean. And then you would fall back on questions of whether there's an ambiguity and then latent versus patent ambiguity.
I know. So the problem with me is the point I made, which I know you clearly understand, combined with the government drafted the contract on top of it. You know, we got a lot of things that are weighing in one direction. But if it is ambiguous, what happens then? Suppose I say, okay, I don't buy the government's argument about the actual requirements language, but what if I say it's at least ambiguous? Then what happens with this case?
So if we decide that both parties' interpretations are within a zone of reasonableness, that's the definition of ambiguity, we then ask whether it was latent or patent. Latent ambiguity requires inquiry on the part of the contractor. I will say quite straight, we did not make this point in our briefs. I'll start with that. But if the court needs to do something.
Who didn't make the point?
We did not.
Oh, okay.
So,
well, they on pages 13 to 16, I'm going to be honest, I don't remember the difference between patent and latent, but I mean, I think I can figure it out actually based on the words. But on pages 13 to 16 of their brief, they made this doctrine of contra preferentum argument. Which one does that go to, and what's your response to it?
So if you'll let me move down this latent patent for a moment.
Okay, please, take your time.
So having determined there's ambiguity, obviously this is a legal question. The court needs to interpret it. Recognizing we didn't focus on patent ambiguities, the question then becomes whether there is such an obvious, glaring ambiguity that the contractor needed to inquire about it. The contracts don't contain the FAR mandated requirements clause, which everyone knows as a constructive matter needed to be in there. And so we would suggest that there was a duty to inquire in this instance. If the court decides that there is not a glaring patent ambiguity, at that point we reach the question of what to do with a latent ambiguity.
And then contra-preferential... When you say which everyone knows should have been in here,
I apologize.
With all due respect, the government drafted this contract, so who do I hold it against if something that everyone knows should have been there wasn't in there? But secondly, many of these government contracts are entered with smaller entities who aren't even necessarily meaningfully represented by knowledgeable government attorneys the way the U.S. government has. So I'm a little hesitant. I don't know the facts of this case, but that's why maybe that goes into some sort of fact-finding related to ambiguity. I don't know. I'm just questioning.
So understanding your Honor's point very, very well, Chief Judge Moore, about the nature of these contractors, nonetheless, contracting parties are charged with knowledge of the pertinent law. That is, I believe, I don't have a case with me, but I believe that's
a
fair
question.
And so they were just as aware as the VA, equally aware, it's a concession there to some extent, that it needed to be in there. And so that would raise a duty to inquire.
The law doesn't say it needs to be in there. The law says it would be better if it's in there.
I don't think that's true. I believe that FAR 16.50.
I thought that our case said that there's, you know, it weighs strongly if the FAR is.
Yes, we're talking about slightly different things. The FAR mandates it, and we are not taking the position that it cannot be a requirements contract because it lacks the clause. That's not what we've said, obviously. So, yes, the court can find it as a requirements contract despite the lack of adherence to the FAR requirement. That's my point. So, with respect to contra preferentum, Your Honor, there's a four-part analysis. A, contract specifications drawn by the government, true here. B, the language is susceptible to more than one interpretation. I'm assuming that the court is reaching that point. B, the contractor actually and reasonably... three, the intention of the parties does not otherwise appear. And four, the contractor actually and reasonably construed the specifications in accordance with this meaning. With respect to the intent of the part, well, we make our points that only one interpretation is reasonable here. With respect to the question of intent of the parties, Caring Hands has not pulled forth anything to suggest that the parties did intend that these be requirements contracts. And the only thing that's been pointed to is a single email on the record.
We don't know. There's really nothing truly in the record about the intent of the parties, is there?
I believe that is a fair statement. Our position has been that the email, the only thing that's been pointed to.
Brought in the person that wrote the contract and said, were you trying to write a requirement? What kind of contract are you trying to write?
Correct, Your Honor. The only evidence in the record is this one email, which we've said doesn't demonstrate anything.
And typically, in a latent ambiguity context, the party that's arguing on the hoping to find it's a latent ambiguity is supposed to say that he relied on it to his detriment, and we don't have any evidence to that effect, right?
That's right, Your Honor.
So, I mean, even if there is a latent ambiguity, the contractor doesn't win automatically. You have to show that he, in essence, with his interpretation that he thought existed, he took steps to rely on it or to his detriment.
Correct.
So it seemed to me that if we decided there was a latent ambiguity, you'd remand the case.
Yes, Your Honor. We agree with that. Yes. Correct.
Would you mind addressing the 2014 contract?
Sure. The main question that's come up is...
And if you have more on 2015, I'm not meaning to push you off of it.
I think I've said enough, Your Honor.
Okay.
With respect to the 2014 contract, the main point that's been raised is this presence or absence of a similar performance work statement.
The board... am I right that the board concluded these are IDIQ contracts?
Correct, Your Honor. The board did conclude that they were IDIQ contracts. It found the 2015 contracts illusory and the 2014 to be IDIQ.
With respect to that point, where is there any minimum quantity stated, period?
So, Your Honor, the schedules...
In the schedules we have, there is no minimum quantity named.
Correct, Your Honor. I read
them
similarly.
Even if you view the minimum maximum clause as being a minimum quantity, which you submit it tells you can't, even if you do, there is nothing stated in it because of blanks.
Yes, Your Honor. That's right. So
how can this possibly be an IDIQ contract?
Your Honor, we agree with that read of the schedules. Caring Hands' point here is that these are requirements contracts. Right, and so
my point is, it seems to me that in any event, these can't qualify as IDIQ contracts, and that's why I believe your adversary wisely shifted and said, I basically want these things to be requirement contracts, and I want to go back and have some testimony about what we really intended here. And he's saying, because there's an issue of fact here, I may be able to get access to the statement of work clause. And if he convinced the court on the 2015 contracts, us, if that was a requirements contract, he's going to win on the 14, and he's willing to put his eggs all in that basket. Right? And that's what I'm thinking.
Wait.
Wise man.
Your Honor, with respect to these 2014 contracts, I'll say...
But why isn't there a question of fact? Because we know from the contract
that
there was supposed to be a statement of work, the clause that has the magic words in 2015. We know that there was one in the contract, right?
No, Your Honor.
The contract says attached here to is, or whatever it says.
Yes.
Right. And so is the government telling me that that necessarily means there's some doubt as to whether there was going to be one in it?
Your Honor, there's no doubt.
There are two questions here. One was there going to be this, I'll call it a statement of work, information in the 14 contract, yes or no? And if the answer is yes, there was, then the question was, well, what was it? That opens then the question of talking to the contractors, etc.
So, with respect to the first question, Your Honor, we don't have testimony talking about intent to have put that in there, but the reference to the performance work statement on the schedule.
So, maybe we remand on that point, and we say it's unclear. It's unclear from the record whether there is a dispute of material factor because was any of this raised? Has any of this been forfeited?
Right. So it has been forfeited because the parties entered into the contract as is. There's nothing in this record to suggest that these contracts, as executed, contained the performance work statement. Yes, they contain the reference, but they don't contain the performance work statement. This is a statement.
Well, we know they're not in the contract because they're not in the record. We have what is purportedly the entirety of the contract documents.
Right, and we don't have a suggestion that there's a mutual mistake or something went wrong in the execution here, but rather...
Just one clarification. Are you saying there is no attachment and no amount of discovery in the world will turn one up? Doesn't the first page say that there's an attachment
or
something?
Yes, it does.
But we don't have it in this record, so are you saying there isn't one at all and that was an error, or... I'm confused.
Sure. I am not saying that the... I am saying that Caring Hands has not raised an issue of genuine material fact to suggest that these ever contain these performance work statements. There is deposition testimony that's been pointed to, but that deposition testimony only says that if it had been in here, it would have been similar, or it might have been similar, actually. The deposition testimony is more equivocal than my friend suggests. And so, but that doesn't raise a genuine issue of material fact as to whether they were actually included, and I see nothing in this record to suggest that these are not the contracts as executed.
You see nothing in the record except for the contract itself that says there's an attachment which is not there.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, that is right.
Let me ask you, I'm just going to help you. These are friendly questions, so just take me at my word. I don't lie about that. The FAR IDIQ clause was included in this contract.
Yes, right? Your Honor. That's
okay. Right. Next, the contract said it did have a minimum, but it had this weird minimum of one order. Is it the government's position that that is $1, or is it the government's position that one order meets the IDIQ requirement that there be a minimum?
Sure. So to reconcile your question and Judge Clevenger's, he is referring, I believe, Your Honor, to the schedule in the contract. So the IDIQ clause, the FAR IDIQ clause that is included in these 2014 contracts says, see the schedule. That contains the minimum.
A minimum will be specified, and that's like a dollar minimum.
Minimum was supposed to be in the schedule.
Yes, that is what the FAR clause says, and that is picking up on Judge Clevenger's question. Your Honor, I believe, pointing to the order limitations clause, and the point that we've made in response to that is that whether it says less than one order or less than one dowler, neither thing makes these requirements contracts. It might undercut the suggestion that they are IDIQ contracts, but it doesn't make them.
And that issue is not on appeal to us, right? Did anyone appeal? I mean, they argue their requirements contracts. If we say we don't see anything in this record that creates a genuine issue of fact about whether they're requirements contracts or something like that, does that end the case? Do I have to get into whether these are proper IDIQ contracts or whether they have flaws?
You do not, Your Honor.
You do not need to reach that.
That the question here is whether they are requirements contracts. There's obviously we
so
have
just
not.
Just answer the question in front of us. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Tolchin, you have some rebuttal time.
So let me focus for a couple more seconds on the 2014 contracts. The questions of fact are based upon the...
You have a minute and 42 seconds, and boy, are you choosing poorly with your time, but go for it.
Let's talk about the 2015
question. That was a really good choice.
Look, your honors are correct that we did raise, I think Judge Clevenger said, what we did is we looked at this, we said these are requirements contracts. Our better argument, obviously, is the 2015 contract, because I think on their face they're requirements contracts. The 2014 contracts, I think, on their face are ambiguous. And the issue then is, as I said, on 2015, we should win.
You just said 2014 are ambiguous. You went back to 2014. You snuck it in.
I snuck it in.
Yeah. Okay. Well, then I'm going to waste your time on it since you decided to do that. 2014 contracts. I don't know how you can. How does their ambiguity turn them into potentially requirement contracts? Whether or not there's a flaw in the definition of them as IDIQ contracts is one question. But that's not you're not disputing whether they're IDIQ contracts. You have to prove that there's at least ambiguity as to whether they're requirements contracts. And I see nothing anywhere that suggests these are requirements.
There is a clause in the 2014 contracts, B.3.1, B.3.1. It says there, the contractor shall furnish all, got the word all in there, shall furnish all labor, transportation, materials, tools,
equipment. Can you be both an IDIQ contract and a requirements contract?
Can it be both? I think one is a subset of the other, but I'm not sure, but that's not what we're arguing here. It's
the FAR IDIQ is in this contract.
The FAR IDIQ clause is in this contract.
So why doesn't that end it? It may not be a perfect IDIQ. It may be a flawed IDIQ, but how does, in the face of the FAR IDIQ clause being there, how can you argue it's ambiguous as to whether it was meant to be a requirements contract?
Well, because if the issue that creates the problem in the IDIQ contract says maybe this is a requirements contract, then that creates the ambiguity.
Okay, your time's up. Bye-bye. B.3.1.
I refer to Bert.
Thank you, counsel.